doing a remote talk 2 weeks ago and is back again. So today she'll talk about On the Road to Cosmic Censorship, a Holographic Argument for the Penrose Inequality in ADS. At a practical level, you can just interact with the speaker as you would in a normal seminar, but just try to speak loudly and clearly towards the front of the room, and it should all work fine, I hope. So the floor is yours, Neda.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me to speak virtually again. This talk is, I would say, it's a statement. This is a talk about the Penrose inequality, which is not super familiar to most of the holographic community. So I think of it as a stop on the road to understanding whether cosmic censorship is true or false. And that's what's responsible for this title page. The road is long, and maybe Penrose inequality is a stop on the road. So this is based on work with Gary Horowitz, a paper that came out last week. And we're still working on some follow-ups, but today I'm probably not going to mention those. They're fairly preliminary. So let me begin with a bit of motivation about why you should care about cosmic censorship, much less the Penrose inequality. So I'm going to begin with three fun facts. The first fun fact is that generic solutions to the Einstein equation have singularities. And singularities here, I'm really talking about geodesic incompleteness. Now, there's a second fun fact, which is that we have never observed a singularity, ever. And the third fun fact is that the Einstein equations describe the universe pretty well. So these three facts appear to be at least in some tension with one another. Generic solutions have singularities. Our universe appears to be fairly generic, and yet we've never observed a singularity. And what we see, really, the way that these facts are resolved, that in our universe, empirical evidence suggests that singularities are hidden behind event horizons. So it's not that there are no singularities in our universe, but that they are hidden behind event horizons. Now, as someone who primarily works with holography and string theory, it's very unusual for me to have any kind of empirical evidence to guide me. I'm going to relish this moment and emphasize that this is guided by empirical evidence. And it is quite rare for us to have it, so we should really pay it close attention. So the fact that in our universe there appears to be the case that singularities are cloaked by event horizons led Roger Penrose to conjecture a cosmic censor, the sort of fanciful terminology saying that nature abhors a naked singularity. Slightly more precisely, in nature, singularities are always cloaked behind event horizons. And I'll say a much more precise version of this later in the talk. This excludes the Big Bang singularity, and there's a precise way in which we exclude it, and there's a reason for that as well. Now, this is both a good thing and a bad thing. It's a good thing in the sense that this would explain why in our universe we don't see singularities, while it's still true that our universe is really well described by GR. GR is a really good effective field theory. And it would help us settle those three facts. On the other hand, it's pretty sad as well, because it would mean that we can never directly observe strong quantum gravity at physics from a naked singularity. So there's a sense in which we have hopes that this is true, and we have hopes that this is false, and we'd like to figure out which one it is. Is it true? Is it false? If it's false, should we start looking for signatures of naked singularity somewhere in the cosmos? So cosmic censorship, to be a little more precise, comes in two different flavors, strong flavor and weak flavor, strong cosmic censorship and weak cosmic censorship. This suggests that maybe the strong version implies the weak version. This is actually not true. Neither one implies the other. So this is just poor terminology. Now, neither strong cosmic censorship nor weak cosmic censorship have ever been proven. And in fact, there are now counterexamples for both types of cosmic censorship. Now you might ask me at this point, if we know that there are counterexamples, why are you giving this talk in the first place? Clearly the conjecture is false. But just because cosmic censorship is violated for particular solutions of the Einstein equation doesn't mean that those solutions necessarily admit a UV completion within quantum gravity. They could be spurious solutions that are unphysical and simply do not manifest in a complete UV complete theory of gravity. So if quantum gravity really does prefer to hide singularities behind event horizons, then cosmic censorship, or maybe some milder, some relaxed version of cosmic censorship, would be a really deep fact about nature and something that we really ought to investigate. So how do we investigate something like this? Well, it's a bit like any other thing that we need to figure out about quantum gravity. We'd like to understand if quantum gravity does something, but in order to understand that, we need to have a theory of quantum gravity, so we're caught in a bit of a loop. Now, fortunately, normally when we're stuck in these types of situations, this is where we resort to the ADS-CFT correspondence, because that is a formulation of non-perturbative quantum gravity, even though we usually work in the limit where quantum gravity is semi-classical. So this is the same technique that I'm going to use today. I'm going to use the ADS-CFT correspondence to probe something about cosmic censorship. So I'll begin with background about cosmic censorship, and I actually will not talk about the Penrose inequality until I get to section two. So the first section will be just mostly background about cosmic censorship and the types of violations that exist and what we think the actual correct statement might be in full quantum gravity. Then I'll talk about the Penrose inequality, I'll formulate it, explain why it's considered a litmus test of quantum gravity, and I'll give you the holographic proof that Gary Horowitz and I gave. I'll talk a little bit about some implications of this. There are some nice applications and implications of this inequality in ADS, and I'll just conclude with a summary and some exciting new ideas. So let me begin with some background. So here is the statement of cosmic censorship. Roger Penrose in 69, I will only talk about weak cosmic censorship. I have nothing to say about strong cosmic censorship at this point. The statement that naked singularities are invisible to an asymptotic observer other than an initial Big Bang singularity. So this was initially formulated for asymptotically flat space, but there's a way of formulating it for ADS as well. Now, I don't know if there are any mathematicians in the audience, but mathematicians would not like this way of formulating cosmic censorship. It's not very precise. So for those mathematicians in the audience, I've written in small print the precise correct way of formulating cosmic censorship, which is that the maximal Cauchy development of a set of generic asymptotically flat or ADS initial data is asymptotically flat or asymptotically ADS and strongly asymptotically predictable, which in particular means you have a complete scribe plus, so complete conformal boundary. Now here is a picture that I've drawn with ADS boundary conditions, where you have an initial data surface with very good, perfectly generic initial data, which evolves to a naked singularity. And this would be a gross violation of weak cosmic censorship, or what I'm just going to call cosmic censorship. So what do we know about violations of cosmic censorship? Well, in five or more dimensions, there's a Gregor-Laflamme type instability that results in a pinch-off singularity. So here I have a picture of a black string, which was shown in 2010 by Lois Lehner and Franz Pretorius to have a singularity. There's a pinch-off singularity in this in the black string. This was followed up by work for the black ring and the Myers-Perry black hole. So it appears that in five or more dimensions for asymptotically flat space, cosmic censorship is violated. Now, I don't actually know of any counterexamples to cosmic censorship in four flat space-time dimensions, in four space-time dimensions which are asymptotically flat. But at least in five or more dimensions, we do have this instability. Now, it's not such a bad singularity in that it's just a pinch off, but there are now also violations in ADS, which are much worse. So recently there's been a set of papers by Horowitz and Santos, and also joined by Toby Crisford, where they found counterexamples for cosmic censorship for asymptotically ADS-4 initial data. So this is in four space-time dimensions. It's not asymptotically flat, but it is four space-time dimensions, and these are pretty bad violations of cosmic censorship. Now, as I said, the initial known violations were pretty mild. There's a pinch-off singularity or chop to a critical collapse. These are small violations. In the sense that you could imagine that this is really localized to a Planck-sized region. And most likely, quantum gravity resolves that singularity without any effects that are visible to asymptotic observers. So there's a sense in which we could imagine modifying the cosmic censorship conjecture to allow for these types of mild pinch-off type singularities, these Gregory-Laflamme type instabilities. it wouldn't be crazy. It would seem like just a slightly more mild version of cosmic censorship. So this might suggest that that is valid, but the examples of Crisford, Horowitz, and Santos are rather different. They are numerical, but they appear to be very strongly indicating that the curvature actually grows without bound in an extended region. So this is a pretty bad violation of cosmic censorship. So this suggests that perhaps cosmic censorship is altogether false. We could have imagined in the first case, in these mild singularities, we could have imagined having a situation where we preserve the spirit of cosmic censorship, even if not the letter. But these violations of Crisford, Horowitz, and Santos are bad enough that it's not clear if we were allowing them, if we could even allow for the spirit of cosmic censorship in any way. So this is where we ask, can quantum gravity help us? Is there a reason that quantum gravity would be opposed to these counterexamples by Crisford, Horowitz, and Santos? So these counterexamples are specifically for Einstein-Maxwell in ADS-4. And they found a very interesting connection here. So they found that if you add a charge scalar, and if the charge-to-mass ratio satisfies the weak gravity conjecture, which is a conjecture about quantum gravity, then cosmic censorship is no longer violated. So this suggests that even though cosmic censorship can be badly violated in solutions to general relativity, it won't be violated, except potentially very mildly in these Gregory-Laflamme type instabilities, to solutions to general relativity that do admit a UV completion. So this would be a very nice story that would tell us that there are special solutions in general relativity that can be UV completed and a class of solutions that that cannot be. So we're going to test this or think of, we're going to take one test of it, again, with something we think of as a litmus test in the context of ADS-CFT. So I think this audience probably very familiar with ADS-CFT. It's just the obligatory slide. We have the soup can picture, a D plus one dimensional string theory, D plus one plus compact directions with ADS boundary conditions is dual to a D dimensional gauge theory. And the gauge theory is non-gravitational. It lives on a copy of the asymptotic boundary. And we call the bulk, they call the ADS theory the bulk. And in this case, we'd like to work with the GR limit, the classical limit of a D plus one dimensional string theory in the bulk. So this concludes the background. I hope I've motivated enough why we are curious about cosmic censorship, in particular in the context where we know we have a quantum theory of gravity. So now let's move on to the Penrose inequality. So what is the Penrose inequality and what does it have to do with cosmic censorship? Now, the Penrose inequality is a conjecture about apparent horizons, about the area of apparent horizons. So you might ask, well, that's a little bit counterintuitive for us. We usually work, numerical relativists tend to work with the apparent horizon, but those of us who do quantum gravity, we tend to work more with the event horizon. So why would you care about the apparent horizon? And partly, this is because the Penrose inequality is meant to be a conjecture about initial data that satisfies weak cosmic censorship. So because this is a conjecture about initial data, it has to be data that can be identified in finite time, in particular on a Cauchy slice. Now, the event horizon is, of course, defined with respect to scribe plus. So it's impossible for us to determine where the event horizon is if it exists on a Cauchy slice without time evolving it. And that defeats the purpose of the inequality in the first place. So this conjecture instead is about apparent horizons. Now, I'd like to just remind those of you who do not remember what the definition of the apparent horizon is. So let's recall just some facts about light rays, null congruences. So here we have a compact surface sigma, and there are two ways to fire light from sigma towards the future. So there's the ingoing light rays, so I've marked these as L, and the outgoing light rays, which I've marked as K. These generate two null hypersurfaces, the outgoing ones, which are the purple ones, and the ingoing ones, which are the orange. Now, the way I've drawn it in this picture, and it agrees with our approximately flat space intuition, which says that the future outwards congruence should be expanding in cross-sectional area, and the future inwards congruence should be shrinking in cross-sectional area. In other words, if you fire light outwards, you expect it to expand. And if you fire light inwards, you expect it to contract. This is fine in asymptotically flat space, in approximately flat space, but in curved space, the outgoing light rays can contract, the ingoing light rays can expand. So this intuition is no longer correct. Now, we can use the fact that light rays are in some sense trapped inside a surface very close to a black hole singularity to define the boundary of a black hole locally. In particular, near a black hole singularity, or very close to a big crunch, space-time volume contracts. So the ingoing light rays, as before, will be contracting, but the outgoing light rays are going to be contracting as well. And this is a sense in which no matter how you fire a light from your surface, it's going to contract. So there's a sense in which that is equivalent to no matter how you fire light rays from the surface, it goes inwards, it's contracting. The light is trapped inside the surface. This is a local notion of light being trapped, which is indeed what we associate with a black hole. Now, very far from a black hole, we expect that our approximately flat space intuition is valid. So ingoing light rays will still contract, outgoing light rays will now be expanding. These are what we call normal surfaces, simply because they agree with our intuition. So if we think of the black hole as being populated by trapped surfaces, and we think of the black hole exterior as being populated by normal surfaces, then between the two regions, we have surfaces where the ingoing light rays are contracting, since they contract both for the black hole and for the region outside the black hole. But the outgoing light rays will be neither contracting nor expanding, simply by continuity. So this is this very nice notion, a very nice quasi-local notion of the boundary of the black hole. If we take the outermost surface on some Cauchy slice, whose outgoing light rays are not expanding, if we take that to be the black hole boundary, that's a quasi-local, or a notion which is local in time, of the black hole boundary. So here's the actual definition of an apparent horizon. An apparent horizon is the outermost surface on a Cauchy slice whose outgoing null rays are non-contracting. So in this cartoon here, we have the event horizon. And remember, the area of the event horizon increases generically. This means that the outgoing light rays are expanding. And deep inside the black hole, you see the outgoing light rays are contracting. So, and between the event horizon and that region, we have an apparent horizon. Now, in a very special case of a stationary black hole, the event horizon actually is foliated by apparent horizons. So apparent horizons are codimension 2, the event horizon is codimension 1, and for stationary black holes, the event horizon is foliated by apparent horizons. Okay, so having defined the apparent horizon, let's now talk about the Penrose inequality as it follows from cosmic censorship and a few other assumptions. Now, I'm going to be historically accurate for just a moment here. So I'm going to assume we have a four-dimensional asymptotically flat space-time, total mass m, so I mean the ADM mass, and an apparent horizon sigma. Now, cosmic censorship implies that apparent horizons lie behind event horizons. So assume now, and this is, I'll say a few words about this assumption in a moment, assume now that the area of an apparent horizon is smaller than the area of an event horizon on some Cauchy slice. So if I go back to the previous slide, assume that the area of this event horizon is, that there exists a Cauchy slice on which the area of the event horizon is larger than the area of the apparent horizon. This is actually known to be false in certain cases for the definition that I've given of the apparent horizon. I'm going to say more about this later. The long and the short of it is that we're going to suggest a refinement of the apparent horizon where this statement is in fact always correct. So assume censorship, assume that the area of the apparent horizon is smaller than the area of the event horizon. Assume the null energy condition, which in turn tells us that the area of the event horizon increases with time. Altogether, this means that the area of our apparent horizon is less than or equal to the area of the event horizon at some finite time, which is less than or equal to the area of the event horizon at a final time. Now assume that any black hole settles down to a Kerr solution. That means that the area of the black hole at late times is equal to the area of a Kerr black hole with mass m. M, again, is the ADM mass of the black hole, which is less than the area of Schwarzschild with mass m, which is equal to 16 pi m squared. Now, we can put the inequalities together. And that tells us that the area of sigma is less than or equal to the area of a Schwarzschild black hole with mass m. So cosmic censorship, together with these other assumptions, implies that the ADM mass is larger than the square root of the area of any apparent horizon over 16 pi. This is the Penrose inequality. It's a statement about it's a bound, lower bound on the mass in terms of the area of an apparent horizon, if you like, an upper bound on the area of the apparent horizon in terms of the mass. And this follows from cosmic censorship. So we often consider this to be a litmus test of cosmic censorship on a Cauchy slice. Now, an analogous equation can be derived from a version of cosmic censorship in ADS, under a similar set of assumptions, and also assuming reflecting boundary conditions at infinity. So in general, the ADS Penrose inequality is the following statement. So let sigma be an apparent horizon in d dimensions. So the last slide was four dimensions, now I'm generalizing. So let sigma be an apparent horizon in d dimensions, and let m be the space-time mass. Then the area of sigma is going to be less than or equal to the area of a static ADS black hole with mass m. This is the Penrose inequality. This is what we think of as a test for cosmic censorship. Now, the previous argument has a few issues in that, well, it talks about this apparent horizon having area smaller than the event horizon, which isn't always clear. It relies on black holes also settling down to Kerr, which we don't know is necessarily true. But under those assumptions, we do have a Penrose inequality from cosmic censorship. And this is the reason that we think of the Penrose inequality as a test of cosmic censorship. It's good, if it's true, we suspect that it's good evidence in favor of some version of cosmic censorship. So in particular, it's not going to tell us anything about space-times that say don't have any apparent horizons at all and still manage to violate cosmic censorship. But nonetheless, we expect that we can probably reverse the Penrose inequality to get potentially some version of a statement which is analogous to a mild form of cosmic censorship. Now, proving cosmic censorship is very hard. We know that there are cases where it's false. We don't know how generic that is, how general. Now, proving the Penrose inequality without assuming cosmic censorship might be easier. After all, this is a statement about a Cauchy slice, not a statement about time evolution of some data. And in general, those can be easier statements. And if we can prove it, then we have some evidence that there's something going in favor of cosmic censorship. So what's the current status on that? Well, without assuming cosmic censorship, there are proofs of the Penrose inequality in the asymptotically flat case, which is Riemannian. So this is not general. This does not prove the Penrose inequality in general Lorentzian spacetimes. And even less is known about the asymptotically ADS case. There are a few results, and I've listed them here, but very little is actually understood. Now, of course, thanks to recent results, we know that cosmic censorship, in fact, can be violated for asymptotically ADS-4 initial data. So we don't expect that there is a general Penrose inequality for generic asymptotically ADS spacetimes. We don't expect that we can just prove it mathematically without any other assumptions about the theory. Maybe, however, there is a Penrose inequality for asymptotically ADS spacetimes with a UV completion. So this was our line of reasoning in looking for a Penrose inequality in ADS CFT. So here's what we showed. We proved, or argued, if you don't think holography is rigorous enough for proofs, we argued that holography implies an ADS Penrose inequality. So let sigma be an apparent horizon in an asymptotically ADS spacetime with mass m, and a few other assumptions that I will be stating later. These assumptions do not include cosmic censorship. Assuming the holographic entanglement entropy proposal, which I'll go over in the next slide, and assuming ADS CFT in general, we can prove that the area of an apparent horizon is less than or equal to the area of a static ADS black hole with mass m. So this is an argument for spacetimes that admit a CFT dual. Okay, let's go through the argument. So the first step in the argument relies rather crucially on the HRT prescription for holographic entanglement entropy. So let me quickly remind you of what that argument is. So here we have we've taken a boundary region R, so I've drawn it in both figures. One figure is in three dimensions. The other figure has time not suppressed, so they each have their own advantages. So we take some boundary subregion R, and we consider the reduced density matrix on this region R. The von Neumann entropy of that can be computed by the area of a particular surface in the dual bulk theory. The surface XR has the following properties. It is the minimal area surface, which is homologous to R, and is a stationary point of the area functional. So here I've drawn XR in two different cases. This WR region is the entanglement wedge. So if there, by assumption one, there is a homology hypersurface between XR and R, and WR is just the domain of dependence of that region. K here and L are two of the two null vectors that generate the boundary of this domain of dependence. So I'm taking L here to be path directed. So this, as I've drawn it here, it looks like it's applied to subregions in particular, but you can also take this to apply to a full boundary. You can just take R to be a complete connected component of the asymptotic boundary. If you want, you can take it to be both many components if you have multiple boundaries, and this formula is still correct. In the case of a pure state, the XR will just be the empty set, but more generally, if you're in a mixed state, say a two-sided black hole, XR will be some compact surface. Okay, so now let's go to some space-time with an apparent horizon. Here I've drawn it as if it were behind the event horizon, but I am not assuming that. So here's our apparent horizon, and there's this wedge that's the region outside of the apparent horizon. That's the region between sigma and the asymptotic boundary, which is space-like to sigma. So that's everything inside, as you can see my mouse, but this is everything inside this region over here. Now, there was a construction by myself and Aaron Wall last year, where we reconstructed a new space-time from this original space-time, where we fix this region here. We don't alter this region. And we sort of empty out the interior of the apparent horizon, and instead we glue a different space-time there. What is the advantage of that? Well, as we'll see in a minute, the second space-time that we glue in has a second boundary. And as a result of that, the von Neumann entropy of the new state, dual to the space-time, the new space-time we constructed, has a non-zero entanglement entropy. And in fact, we'll show that for this particular choice of coarse grain of space-time that we build in the next slide, the von Neumann entropy is exactly equal to the area of sigma. So here is this new space-time. So this is the outer wedge, the exterior of sigma right here. This is the region which we do not alter. And we build a new space-time simply by the characteristic initial data problem in general relativity. We just provide initial data on this hypersurface over here. This is now a stationary null hypersurface, which basically means that the area of sigma is identical to the area of X. And we actually are able to prove that we can provide the data necessary so that X is an extremal surface. And in particular, it is the minimal area extremal surface, which is homologous to the original boundary. Meaning that in the new state that is dual to this geometry, tracing over one boundary and computing the von Neumann entropy is computed by the area of X. And because this is a stationary hypersurface, that is also computed by the area of sigma. Now, I need to have a brief aside here on a technicality. I mentioned before that I'm going to have to refine the notion of an apparent horizon. And the reason is that we actually are only able to do this gluing if we make a certain assumption about sigma. This assumption is fairly generic for apparent horizons, so you shouldn't be too put off by the fact that we have to make this assumption. But since I want to be precise, let me just tell you what that assumption is. So this is what we called a mini-mar surface. It's a portmanteau of minimal and marginal. So let sigma be a compact, marginally trapped surface, which is homologous to a connected component of the asymptotic boundary. I should say here that at all points and at all times in this talk, I'm assuming that the surface sigma is compact, the apparent horizon is compact. Now, we say that sigma is minimar if it is what's called strictly stably outermost in the math literature. Roughly speaking, intuitively, what that means is that there's a small outwards deformation of sigma, which results in a normal surface. This is pretty intuitive, and indeed, generically, this is true. And two, sigma is the minimal area surface, which is homologous to the boundary on a Cauchy slice of its exterior. So let me, so here is a picture. This is the outer wedge. Here is a Cauchy slice. And we are assuming that every surface on this Cauchy slice, which circumscribes sigma, has area larger than it. Now, I want to make a point here, which is that this actually circumvents the assumption that Roger Penrose had to make in his argument. In particular, the assumption that that the area of the apparent horizon is smaller than the area of the event horizon. This guarantees that that is the case. So for Minimark surfaces, the only assumptions you have to make to actually prove the Penrose inequality for ADS from cosmic censorship is that black holes settle down to Kerr. Now, as I said, under certain generic conditions and assuming smoothness, apparent horizons are Minimark. Okay, so that aside is done with. So now remember, we have this new spacetime that we've constructed. And assuming the null energy condition, there's a surface X, which has the same area as the area of sigma, and it is the HRT surface. So they call this the coarse grain spacetime, because the old spacetime had vanishing von Neumann entropy, and the new spacetime has non-vanishing von Neumann entropy. So there exists a spacetime, M prime G prime, that's this two-sided geometry, in which the area of X is equal to the area of sigma, and X is the HRT surface of one boundary of M prime. In particular, this means that there exists a state rho in the CFT, dual to M prime G prime, and the von Neumann entropy of the state is equal to the area of one boundary of the state, one connected component of the boundary, is equal to the area of the apparent horizon over 4G H bar. This culminates step one for us. I should say that there's an exclusive alternative here, which is the potential possibility that the HRT prescription is wrong or incomplete. So this is why we assumed that the HRT prescription is correct and pushed forwards. If you are not likely to buy that, you can see our proof as an exclusive alternative. Either the Penrose inequality holds or the HRT prescription is wrong. Okay, moving on to step two. Remember that we fixed this outer wedge region. We fixed this exterior region over here. That means that the asymptotic charges outside of sigma are identical in our new spacetime and our old spacetime. In particular, the mass is going to be the same in the two spacetimes, which also means that the CFT energy is going to be identical. So this now immediately implies a nice inequality. Here we have the statement we had before. This is just the results of constructing the new spacetime, where the von Neumann entropy is equal to the area of the apparent horizon. Now, we know that this state has energy E, which is, again, the same as the energy in the original state. So because this is a state with energy E, this means that if we take the maximum von Neumann entropy with the fixed energy, then this is going to only be larger than that, because now we're maximizing over a set of which rho is a member. This, of course, is simply the microcanonical ensemble. Now, it was recently argued by Don Merrill that in the large N limit, the microcanonical ensemble is dominated by static black holes, even if they are small. And as you say, there's a small caveat here, which is that we are assuming that the energy is non-zero to leading order in N. So the von Neumann entropy of the microcanonical ensemble is equal to the area of a static black hole with mass M over 4G H bar. Okay, so putting this all together, and I guess this is missing a 4 here, the area of our apparent horizon is equal to the von Neumann entropy of rho times 4G H bar. This was the first step. This was the construction of this coarse grain spacetime. Then, as a result of maximizing the entropy subject to fixing the energy, we know that this is going to be less than or equal to 4G H bar times the von Neumann entropy of the canonical ensemble. Finally, thanks to Don's argument, we know that this is equal to the area of a static ADS black hole with mass M. Finally, we get a Penrose inequality in ADS. The area of any apparent horizon is less than or equal to the area of a static black hole, static ADS black hole, with mass M. So this was a very simple proof, using admittedly a number of ingredients that have been established and people have worked very hard to establish, but nonetheless, the proof at its root is a one-line proof of the Penrose inequality in ADS. And the fact that it follows in such a natural way, it suggests that it really is a very important, not important, perhaps a very basic aspect of ADS-CFT. Now, this is specifically for fixing the mess, but I said before here that the charges are all going to be the same because both of the spacetimes that we construct have the same outer wedge. So we can also fix the charge if we like. And what we're going to get is the same statement. We're just going to get a static charged ADS black hole with mass m and charge q, where m and q are as in our original spacetime. For spacetimes that do have charge, that will provide a tighter inequality, simply because the black hole, the static black hole with mass m, is always going to be larger than the static black hole with mass m and charge q. And I want to emphasize that at no point here did we assume cosmic censorship. This was not put in the argument in any way. And so this is a proof of the Penrose inequality within holography, which is completely independent of cosmic censorship, of whether it holds or not. Okay, let me say a few words now about implications. Still doing okay on time. Okay, so now apparent horizons have this nice property. If you foliate them, if you generate them from foliation, that's just right, that they satisfy an area monotonicity theorem. So here I've drawn a hypersurface. This blue-green hypersurface is foliated by apparent horizons. Every single one of these is an apparent horizon. Now, if some of you in the audience are wondering, wait a second, I thought the apparent horizon was the outermost marginally trapped surface on a Cauchy slice. There apparently are other marginally trapped surfaces here. And the answer is just that, well, it's not on this Cauchy slice. There's another Cauchy slice that goes through this surface where that is the outermost one. Now, so apparent horizons satisfy an area monotonicity theorem. The area of this is smaller than the area of that, which is smaller than the area of that. That is, the area increases as we evolve monotonically in this direction. Now, this corresponds, of course, to the area increasing as we evolve forwards in time in the boundary times here, which correspond to the boundary of the past of these apparent horizons. So this bears pointing out a connection with thermodynamics, simply because there's been some talk of connecting thermodynamics to cosmic censorship in recent years. So remember the state M prime G prime, this two-sided black hole that we constructed by fixing the apparent horizon exterior and just modifying the interior. So the entropy of that state is what computes the area of sigma, but it's also actually the maximum of all possible entropies that are consistent with sigma, so in particular with the outside of sigma. So in particular, we know that the area of sigma over 4G H bar is equal to the maximum of the von Neumann entropy over all states in this set H, where H is a set of all rho with a semi-classical dual that contains the exterior of sigma. Put differently, you're maximizing the von Neumann entropy over all possible interiors of the apparent horizon. This is a coarse-grained entropy. We are coarse-graining over all possible interiors. It, in some sense, measures your ignorance of what is behind, of the possible geometry you could stick behind the apparent horizon. And we coined this a name for this. We called it the outer entropy, since the outside is fixed. Now, why am I telling you about this? The reason is that this area law for apparent horizons corresponds to an increase in the outer entropy. So in particular, you can see here, this area is increasing and the outer entropy is likewise increasing, which means that the outer entropy increases as we move forwards in time on this part. So this area law can be thought of as a second law of thermodynamics. And there's a nice way to see this as well from this picture where we're progressively fixing less and less of the space-time data as we evolve along this apparent horizon. So here is, we're fixing this entire large wedge and maximizing the von Neumann entropy subject to fixing this wedge when we're talking about this apparent horizon. And we're maximizing a strictly smaller wedge when we evolve further along this family of apparent horizons. And then we're maximizing an even smaller one. So of course the maximum goes up. We're maximizing progressively subject to fewer constraints. Okay, so now we say, okay, this area law corresponds to some kind of a second law of thermodynamics. We understand it. There's this outer entropy. That's what's increasing. But of course, the apparent horizon, we also now have an understanding of its area in terms of the Penrose inequality. So how is this related? Well, so here we have our apparent horizon as before, and we're firing this back down here. This is time t naught. Now, with reflecting boundary conditions, the energy at t naught will generically give the lowest bound. So generically, we expect that as we insert sources, the generic sources are only going to cause the energy to increase. So as we evolve, so if we have this apparent horizon over here, and then we move further along to apparent horizon over here, that will result in another null congruence fired in this direction, which will only result in a mass going, which will only have a higher bound for the mass from below. So put differently, we can maximize with respect to the mass at any point on this part of the asymptotic boundary. We pick to maximize it to get the tightest bound. We maximize the bonum and entropy subject to fixing the energy at its lowest, which generically will be at T naught. This means that as we evolve to the next apparent horizon along this the surface that I had over here, as we evolve to the next one, what will happen is that generically the energy is going to go up, which is, of course, quite consistent with the fact that the area of the apparent horizon is going up. So the mass has to go up if it's going to accommodate the fact that the area of the apparent horizon is bounded by the mass. So this is a potential relation between the Penrose inequality and gravitational thermodynamics. And so there have been some discussion of cosmic censorship and gravitational thermodynamics being related. This appears to be lending evidence in favor of that. It's not, I don't think anything precise has been said yet, but it's evidence that we should maybe be thinking, it's evidence in favor of us thinking about this a little more seriously. Okay, now another implication or application actually rather of this formalism or of this proof of the Penrose inequality. Now, it's possible to define the outer entropy of a general surface actually. So nothing stops you from just taking sigma to be an arbitrary surface, fixing its exterior, and then maximizing the bonum and entropy subject to that fixed exterior. Sigma doesn't have to be an apparent horizon. It may not be equal to the area when it's not an apparent horizon, but you can still do that. You can still define the outer entropy. Now, for a normal surface, one where the outgoing light rays are expanding and the ingoing light rays are contracting, the outer entropy is bounded by the area. So the area of a normal surface N gives an upper bound on the outer entropy of the surface N. Now, it's been recently proposed that the outer entropy is a good candidate for a quasi-local gravitational mass. And it's been shown that it satisfies a number of desirable conditions, like, for example, monotonicity under inclusion. As the region gets larger and larger, the outer entropy increases as well. So, in fact, using exactly the same argument that Gary and I used to prove the Penrose inequality, it's simple to show that the outer entropy of a normal surface is bounded above by the total mass. You actually can't show this in the other ways that the techniques that were developed in this paper. They were not able to show this. Maybe they didn't try, but they didn't do it. And it's incredibly simple to show it using exactly, just run through the same proof with a normal surface instead of with an apparent horizon. So it's a nice application, and it seems to suggest that this might be a nice candidate indeed for quasi-local gravitational mass. At least it's a sanity check. Okay, one final, I don't have to call this an implication or suggestion, connection with the weak gravity conjecture. Now, as I said, there's this paper by Toby Crisford, Gary Horowitz, and George Santos, which found that the weak cosmic censorship is satisfied when the weak gravity conjecture is satisfied, at least in their class of examples, but it can be violated when weak gravity is violated. So you could say that, well, in ADS CFT, there's a bunch of arguments by Daniel Harlow that suggests that in general, we expect the weak gravity conjecture to be satisfied, so those solutions that violate it are not allowed in ADS CFT. But it turns out there's a cute connection, which is a bit more direct, between the Penrose inequality and the weak gravity conjecture via Daniel's arguments. So I don't really want to run through all of Daniel's arguments in a lot of detail, but roughly speaking, what we can do is we take this our coarse grain space-time that we've constructed. That's a two-sided geometry. There's a wormhole. And we can use Daniel's procedure to thread a charged Wilson line through the wormhole. This is a boundary-to-boundary Wilson line. Now, Daniel's argument, roughly speaking, says that the Wilson line factorizes, so it has to end on charges on either side x. And because effective field theory has to be produced a connected Wilson line at all scales below some UV cutoff, this requires the bulk electric field to have a fundamental charge. And then he argues that these charges have to be sufficiently light not to form black holes, which gives you basically precisely the weak gravity conjecture, this bound. Now, we used a wormhole in our construction, and so you might say that there's a connection, there's a clear connection to the weak gravity conjecture in our very use of a wormhole to prove a statement, which is a test of cosmic censorship. So by virtue of relying on a wormhole, we have invoked some connection with the weak gravity conjecture. Now, of course, as I said before, you could argue that any spacetime in ADS CFT has to satisfy the weak gravity conjecture by the same arguments. But this is simply a more direct connection that is suggestive, given that we have this nice connection between cases where weak gravity conjecture is satisfied and weak cosmic censorship is satisfied versus when both are violated. Okay, so let me now conclude. So I would say cosmic censorship is maybe one of the most important, longstanding, and outstanding questions about gravity, explaining why we haven't seen a naked singularity yet and whether we are likely to ever see one is probably one of the most important questions that we have yet to answer. Now, it's very hard to prove and it's very hard to probe, but constructing theoretical tests of it and actually using those tests to determine whether we think that some version of it is true or not is extremely important. And the Penrose inequality is one such important test. Now, again, we know that cosmic censorship can be violated. It can be violated in four dimensions in ADS and in higher dimensions in asymptotically flat space. Maybe it can be violated in four dimensions in asymptotically flat space. There's no proof of it, but certainly no one has been able to engineer a counterexample. But these violations of cosmic censorship in ADS4 violate the weak gravity conjecture, which suggests that they may not actually be limits of quantum gravity if we believe that quantum gravity satisfies the weak gravity conjecture. Now, we proved that within ADS CFT, all spacetimes satisfy Penrose's inequality. This is, I would say, very good evidence in favor of cosmic censorship. Now, we also gave a refinement of apparent horizons for which cosmic censorship implies the Penrose inequality. This argument works much better. Now you only have to assume, well, cosmic censorship, and that black holes settle down to Kerr. So one potential application of this is for those mathematicians among us to attempt to prove the Lorentzian version of the Penrose inequality, bearing these new assumptions in mind, or with these new assumptions being the guiding point. Again, we don't expect that cosmic censorship is in general going to be true, given all of these counterexamples, but it might suggest which class of spacetimes do satisfy it, based on which class of spacetimes satisfy the Penrose inequality with these modified apparent horizons. Again, this bodes very well for cosmic censorship, I would say, at least within the framework of quantum gravity. And this also bodes well for using ADS-CFT to test, maybe someday even prove, cosmic censorship. At the very least, for understanding which versions of cosmic censorship we expect to be true and which versions we expect to be false. Because we don't expect that we can rule out a Gregory Laflamme instability or Chopfu critical collapse in ADS-CFT. Now, if you found this talk interesting and you are excited about the connections between weak gravity conjecture and cosmic censorship and whether cosmic censorship is true or false, we are hosting a workshop, the Gravity Initiative at Princeton, which is a new initiative, is hosting a workshop in April on the weak gravity conjecture and cosmic censorship. We have a number of speakers, from mathematicians to physicists, gravitational physicists and phenomenologists who will be talking about both weak gravity and cosmic censorship. So attendance is free, but you do have to register, so I encourage you to do so. Thank you very much for your attention.
Okay, thanks, Neda, for your nice talk. So I would now open the floor for questions, and I understand that it's better to speak into the mic, so.
Please, yeah.
Anyone?
So, Neda, hi. Just as a general comment, what would you say? So in the case of asymptotic flat spacetimes, the Penrose inequality, as you said, relies crucially in the assumption that the spacetime will settle into a stationary Kerr black hole. And with that, then it follows trivially. But let's say if we still don't know that if black holes in ADS will settle into a stationary black hole. So do you have general comments? So one, either it could push against a general type of Penrose inequality. On the other hand, you can push for maybe trying to settle that question.
Yeah, so I want to maybe make a distinction here. So our proof of the Penrose inequality, of course, doesn't rely on whether black holes settle down or not, since we don't assume cosmic censorship and we don't need to use Penrose's argument at all. It's a completely separate argument. Now, what you're asking, if I understand correctly, is if you do assume cosmic censorship, are the other assumptions that you need to make to get the Penrose inequality from cosmic censorship reasonable assumptions to make about ADS? Am I understanding your question correctly?
No, actually, my question was more like, what still is unsettled, whether...
Are you speaking to the microphone?
So it still is not settled that a curve or a black hole in ADS will settle to a stationary solution, right? So mathematicians will argue very strongly that it won't. But physicists don't seem to want to care about that. On the other hand, suppose you have a family of Penrose inequalities that doesn't assume that. Could you foresee if physicists happen to be quite or sort of right to try and push against that, that maybe there is a sense in which,
I understand. You're saying instead of seeing this as evidence for cosmic censorship, can you see it as evidence for black hole settling down? So I think this becomes a question of CFT thermalization and how generically we expect holographic CFT states to thermalize. But I would say that in general, in ADS CFT, or in general for CFT, for irrational CFTs, we do expect that they're going to thermalize unless you have some really, really fine-tuned setting. Now, this is only the case for, in particular, ADS, asymptotically ADS spacetimes that are described by a CFT dual. So I would say that it's probably pretty clear that if you have a black hole in ADS CFT, generically, it is going to settle down to Kerr because of CFT thermalization. Now, that doesn't mean that, of course, every collapse of initial data will form a black hole. That's where the cosmic censorship comes in. And it doesn't mean that this is going to be true for spacetimes that don't have a CFT dual.
Sorry, so maybe I'm not aware of some of these arguments. So you just said, so if I have a general black hole, let's say a black hole that is large in ADS, you're saying that it's generally expected that it will thermalize, but that goes very much against what mathematicians are arguing, right? They're arguing based on
mathematicians.
Go ahead.
Right. So mathematicians are not worried about which, as far as I understand, they're not worried about which spacetimes have a CFT dual. They're just worried about general spacetimes. Now, the only statements that I can make based on ADS CFT are about spacetimes that have a CFT dual.
Right, but
so what I can tell you.
But would you say that it's a black hole, that a large black hole with a small perturbation in form of gravitational waves should have a CFT dual, right? And if that's the case,
I would expect that depending on the perturbation, I would expect that it will have a CFT dual. If you start with a state that has a CFT dual and you kick it in some mild way, then I would expect that. Now,
but that's precisely. This is precisely one of the contexts where mathematicians would say because the quasi-normal modes do not decay fast enough in ADS. The sharp bound they can put is way too slow a decay to guarantee it at a nonlinear level that will be a thermal state. So I think there is a real big elephant there.
The CFT dynamics suggest that the CFT should thermalize unless you kicked it in a very particular way. And as long as you don't, as you, it does thermalize and doesn't have recurrences, which is generic for an irrational CFT, then you are going to get a Kerr black hole.
So I 100% agree with you, but I think I tend to believe or be more on the err on the side of conservatism, and theorems are stronger than conjectures.
Yes, this is true.
Okay, any more questions?
I don't think the mathematicians have proven that Kerr is unstable.
Neither holographers have proven that the conjecture.
I'm sorry, can you use the mathematicians?
That's okay.
Okay, so I have one more question maybe. Do you understand precisely for which space times the equality is saturated?
I'm so glad you asked. This is actually a very interesting question. No. So in flat space, you have a... in flat space, you have a...
Sorry.
And asymptotically, you don't have that. And in particular, one simple way to see this is that your black hole can be localized to your ADS directions, or it can be actually on the full, say, 10 dimensions of string theory. And the fact that you're going to actually switch back and forth depending on which energies you're at means that there's going to be some energy at which the two are the same. So you actually do not get a rigidity result from the Penrose inequality in ADS. We cannot prove it using our, at least just certainly not using what we do, but it's probably not true in general.
I think that's it. So let's thank Ned again.